Welcome back to our study of the book of Daniel. We have been studying the first half of Daniel, which are the great stories of Daniel's life. They go all the way from when he was a teenager in chapter 1 to our lesson today, where he is over 80 years old and he has seen the rise and the fall of the Babylonian Empire. This lesson, however, presents an interesting challenge. On the one hand, this is probably one of the most famous stories in the Bible, and it's a story that's known by people who've heard of the Bible and never read the Bible. But it also has a bit of a challenge historically, and I'll show you what I mean. Let's start with a brief recap. At the end of Daniel chapter 5, the date is 539 BC, and the Babylonian Empire, Nebuchadnezzar, has conquered the Jews. He has destroyed the temple in Jerusalem. He led them back into exile in Babylon. And then he has died and passed the kingdom on to his successors. And the last of these successors is named Belshazzar. I want to remind you of one small thing we talked about in our last lesson. For a long, long time, people thought that the book of Daniel wasn't accurate, because everyone knew that the last king of Babylon was Belshazzar's father, Nabonidus. And in our last lesson, we talked about how about 150 years ago, there were unearthed some cuneiform tablets which validated the book of Daniel, that Belshazzar was co-regent with his father and did indeed reign from Babylon. And so in 539 BC, it was Belshazzar who was king in Babylon. Babylon was surrounded by Persian armies under Cyrus the Great. And you may remember this great story where Belshazzar, who is bragging about how great he is and drinking out of the gold cups that Nebuchadnezzar had taken from Jerusalem. And in the midst of that, a hand starts writing on the wall. Another great story, famous story from the book of Daniel. Daniel's brought in, an old man, and he's able to interpret it. And he said, "This very night, your kingdom will be demanded from you because of your pride." And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. And so Darius the Mede received the kingdom being about 62 years old. I want you to remember that. So when Darius was, we'll talk about who Darius was in just a moment. But basically, if you remember, the Persian and Median armies were able to divert the river Euphrates and lower the water level low enough that on that very night, while Belshazzar and all of his nobles were feasting, they were able to wade under the walls and conquer the city of Babylon in 539 BC. That's exactly what history tells us. It's exactly what the book of Daniel tells us. From that time on, Cyrus the Great, it's called that because of the magnitude of his kingdom, but we know a lot about Cyrus, the Persian king. Cyrus, the Persian king, was born, this is something worth remembering, in about 600 BC, which, when Babylon was conquered, makes him about 62 years old. He ruled until 530 BC, and there on the slide I've shown you the successors, Cambyses, his son, and then Darius the Great in 522, who's also known for great conquests and building. But one thing I need to tell you about Cyrus is that Cyrus was a very unique ruler. His father was Cambyses the First, and he was the king of Persia, think modern-day Iran. His mother was the daughter of Astyages, who was the king of Media. I'll show you a map in a second, but these two kingdoms were next to each other, and they had been perennial enemies, and both of them, of course, enemies of Babylon, which is modern-day Iraq. But Cyrus was born of a Persian king for a father, and the grandson of the king of the Medes. And it was prophesied that Cyrus would bring the two kingdoms together. Because of his lineage and because of his greatness, Cyrus the Great, he would bring the kingdom of the Medes and the kingdom of the Persians together. And so in historical records, you'll often hear the Persians or the Medes, but under Cyrus, they became one kingdom. And under his successors, they were one kingdom. We know a lot about Cyrus because he was considered to be a great ruler for several reasons, but one of which is his great conquests. The other is the benevolent rule. I mean, it sounds odd to say benevolent about somebody that conquered and killed so many people as he did, but as far as ruling the people, he was not like the Assyrians who came before him, who were brutal, and the Babylonians, who also shared the idea that oppressing people is what kept them from rebelling. Cyrus had a little different point of view. His point of view was, let people stay in their land, let them worship their own gods, as long as they're willing to pay the taxes and be subservient to the Persian Empire, then they could pretty much live their lives as they wished. And so, relatively speaking, he was considered a benevolent ruler. The Greeks in particular really looked up to Cyrus, and there's a great deal of writing. Ctesias was a Greek physician, and he was the physician to the Persian king Artaxerxes II, so about 100 years later than our story. And he wrote A History of Persia. In it, he writes a great deal about Cyrus. Herodotus, the famous Greek historian, in his histories in the 5th century, the 400s BC, writes extensively about the Persian Empire, but also particularly about Cyrus. And then Xenophon, in the 4th century, the 300s, wrote an entire work about Cyrus the Great. So these are just some of the things that were extant during the Persian period and then afterwards the Greek period, Alexander the Great and the Greeks afterwards. And they admired Cyrus and they admired his leadership and held him up as kind of an enlightened ruler. The point I want to make is that history knows a lot about Cyrus and everyone knew who Cyrus was. This is a picture of what the Persian Empire looked like. Under Cyrus, it wasn't quite this big. Cyrus, again, he conquers Babylon in 539, and the following year, in 538 BC, he issues an edict that says, that's basically an edict of religious tolerance throughout the kingdom, but specifically he issues an edict that the Jews who had been exported by Nebuchadnezzar could return to Jerusalem and they could rebuild their temple to their God Yahweh. This is when, in the Bible, you'll see this picked up in the story of Zerubbabel, who is a Jew living in Babylon, who leads a group of people back to Jerusalem. In the ensuing years, they rebuild the temple as best they can. It's not a glorious temple, but they rebuild the temple. And then time goes by, and Jerusalem still doesn't have any walls. And so in the time of Ezra, now we're going to be around 450 BC, you have the books of Ezra and Nehemiah in the Bible. As time progresses, and remember, Ezra the priest came back and reinstituted the reading of the law and people's turning back to God, and Nehemiah, who was the cupbearer to a Persian king in about 450 BC, came back and organized the rebuilding of the walls. So the point I want to make here is I want you to see the biblical story from Daniel down through the minor prophets, down through Ezra and Nehemiah in the Bible as interacting in real history and real people. And these things are coming together and you see God working through his people in the midst of the real historical events of the time. Meanwhile, Cyrus the Great dies and his descendants basically conquer, his son conquers Egypt, and Darius the Great, who follows him after that, spreads further east toward India. And you can see from that map just the magnitude of the Persian Empire. And the Persian Empire is going to last for approximately 200 years before Alexander the Great comes and he begins to make it a Greek empire and begins to conquer them. But here's where I said there was a bit of a problem. Historically speaking, and some criticism of the book of Daniel. Here's how Daniel chapter 6 opens. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps, or governors of this large kingdom, to be throughout the whole kingdom. And over them, he set three high officials to kind of oversee the governors, if you will. And of Daniel was one of them. Now, keep in mind, Daniel is in his 80s at this point, but Daniel has such a good reputation that even the Persian king realized this is a wise counselor who understands how this kingdom has been run, and I want this guy helping run my kingdom as well. And so Daniel was one of the three to whom the governors or satraps should give account so that the king might suffer no loss, meaning so that no one stole tax money, or in other words, justice was dispensed according to the Persian and Median way of doing justice. The problem with this is that it mentions Darius instead of Cyrus. And everyone has known through all of history that Cyrus was the Persian king. Darius, if indeed it's talking about Darius the First, he didn't come until 20 years later. And so critics over time have looked at the book of Daniel and said, you know what, Daniel, just there's something wrong here, that the Bible's not really historically accurate because he got such an obvious thing wrong. So I want to address that before we get into the story of Daniel in the lion's den. I want to talk about this because we've already talked about, and keep in mind that up until the late 1800s, people thought that Daniel chapter 5 was wrong. Until, oh my goodness, turns out Daniel is right and what we had always thought was wrong. When you unearth the cuneiform tablets, the Nabonidus Chronicles, and the Babylonian Chronicles, and you realize, no, Belshazzar really was the real guy and Daniel was right. Historians were wrong. Well, chapter 6 is the same way, except it hasn't been fully resolved yet. So the question then becomes, who is this Darius? We would have expected to see the name of Cyrus. Cyrus appears in the Old Testament. In fact, 150 years or so before this, Isaiah the prophet named Cyrus and said, God is going to lift up Cyrus and he's going to deliver my people, meaning that God was going to use Cyrus to deliver his people. This is long before Cyrus was even born. So it seems unusual that he would use the name Darius. Later in history, I've quoted here Ezra chapter 1. Now remember, this is about 80 years later, and Ezra is getting ready to go back to Jerusalem along with Nehemiah. But he records that Cyrus, the king of Persia, in 538 BC, issued an edict, and he quotes the edict that Cyrus issued, saying, "Thus says Cyrus, the king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem," his temple in Jerusalem. "How whoever among you of his people, may his God be with him, let him go to Jerusalem and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem." And this is historically where Zerubbabel goes back and they begin to do this. But my point in bringing this up is that Ezra knew that Cyrus was the king of the Persians and the Medes who had conquered Babylon. So why this use of Darius? So let's ask that. Let's just bluntly ask the question. Who is this Darius? First of all, the common thinking in secular circles has been that Daniel is mistaken, that he has confused Darius, who was king in this era, with Cyrus, who was king in this time period. One of the reasons for that is because Daniel is set in 539 BC, so this is the conquest of Babylon, and as time goes on, there's a lot of writing about Cyrus the Great, and I talked to you about that in the 4th century and the 3rd century, and though along about 330, because that's really when he did a lot of conquest, is Alexander the Great. And you see the Greek kingdom. As we move on through time, around 167 BC, this is going to be a very important date when we get to the prophecy in our next lesson. One of the descendants of these Greek rulers named Antiochus, ruled at this time. This is also the time of the Maccabees. So this is in between the Old and New Testament. But what makes this interesting is that Daniel's prophecies seem to be predicting exactly what is going to happen in the reign of Antiochus. So, and then you move on and you get to the cross, and the New Testament begins. So, a lot of scholars say, well, first of all, there's no such thing as predicting the future. So Daniel, the book of Daniel, must have been written in this period, after Antiochus Epiphanes, must have been written much, much later. And consequently, whoever wrote the book of Daniel hundreds of years later just didn't know that Cyrus conquered Babylon. They thought Darius conquered Babylon. So one thought would be that Daniel's mistaken. Now, that seems extremely unlikely for several reasons, one of which it's an assumption that Daniel was written later. There's no proof that Daniel was written later. It's just, well, you can't really predict the future, so it must be written later. Well, that's an assumption that's being made. It's an assumption, by the way, that's being challenged by some new technology. I'll bring this up and show that to you in our next lesson. But the Dead Sea Scroll, Daniel is part of the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls written around this time. And there's been some interesting work lately to try to say when was our oldest copy of the book of Daniel. If the oldest copy of the book of Daniel is older than Antiochus, well, that certainly blows that assumption, doesn't it? We'll talk more about that in the next lesson. But for now, the thought was is that you've got a writer, a Jewish writer of the book of Daniel, hundreds of years later, and he just was wrong, didn't understand history. Well, that seems unlikely for two reasons. Number one, Cyrus the Great is so famous throughout all of history. Today, you know Cyrus the Great overthrew Babylon. In the 5th century, the 4th century, the 3rd century, Greek literature, Jewish literature, the book of Ezra, you would have to be a complete hermit to not know that Cyrus conquered Babylon. So it's extremely unlikely that any Jew living at this time in history could possibly not know that Cyrus was the one who conquered it. So it seems unlikely in that respect. The second reason it seems unlikely is several times in the book of Daniel already, we've noticed little details that you almost have to be there to know that. Obviously, Belshazzar, if this person wrote it several hundred years later, he obviously knew that Belshazzar was the co-regent. And scholars up until the 1800s didn't know that. The second thing is, remember little details like Nebuchadnezzar made Daniel second in the kingdom behind himself, but Belshazzar made Daniel third in the kingdom because his father Nabonidus was also ruling. There are a number of little details like that that if you were going to get something wrong, say you're writing something several hundred years later, if you're going to get something wrong, the little details are what you're likely to get wrong, not the big known fact of who actually conquered Babylon. So I'll leave it at that. And I think this is just extremely unlikely. Two other possibilities that are more likely. One is that Darius is the name of a general under Cyrus, and he was the governor of the province. In our last lesson, I mentioned to you a man named Gobryas. You'll see his name spelled a variety of ways. And you can just look at the last lesson and see that this could indeed be this individual who actually led the troops in, conquered Babylon, and killed Belshazzar. But the most likely, in my view, is that Darius and Cyrus are the same people. This makes a lot of sense, and I'll show you as we go through how it can make more sense. But you have to remember that Darius can be a name, but it was also a title. And it's like, think of the word Caesar. Today you think of Caesar was a person, Julius Caesar, but his name came to be a title, the Caesars, the rulers. Darius is kind of like that in the language of the Medes, is that it can also be a title. So I think it's extremely much, much more likely that Daniel understood exactly who conquered it, but was using the name and the title that was very extant at that time. So I went into a lot of detail on that because as we go through this, one of the things I'm emphasizing to you is God working in history. We've talked about the archaeology of this era and how it fits so well. So I really didn't want to skip something that is under current criticism of the book of Daniel. Well, as we move on, it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom these satraps. And so Daniel was going to be one of those. Then this Daniel became distinguished above all the other high officials because an excellent spirit was in him. God was with him. I mean, from the Persian point of view, it's like, this guy's really smart and the gods must speak to him. We know that the God was with him. And the king made a plan to set him over the whole kingdom. So Daniel is so much more experienced, so much better than the Persian and the current other Babylonian leaders is that King Cyrus says, you know what, this is going to be my number two. He's going to be the chief operating officer of the Persian kingdom because this guy is really good. Well, needless to say, people then were very much like people now, and that was a great threat to all of the other officials. Think about politics then and politics now. This is a very modern story happening 2,500 years ago. Is you have resentment, you have jealousy. And consequently, when they found out that this Daniel, who isn't even a Persian, in fact, he's a Jew, who they've been conquered, they're a minor people, how in the world could you set this guy over us? And so they begin to plot and they begin to scheme. If this story were happening today, you could pick up the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal and literally read about it. In fact, you are reading about this today. It just changes the names. You're still reading about political intrigue and undermining your enemies and going to very great lengths to preserve political power. So the king was planning to put Daniel over all of them. Then the high officials and the satraps, the government officials, sought to find a ground for complaint against Daniel. In other words, how can we take this guy down? How can we start a scandal? Let's get social media going against this guy. But they could find no ground for complaint or any fault because he was faithful and no error or fault was found in him. In other words, he just did his job really well. He was honest. He was efficient. He wasn't scheming against the king. He wasn't plotting. He basically was just doing his job, and he was doing it really well. And they realized, these men said, we shall never find any ground for complaint against Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God. Wow, that is an interesting thing to say. I mean, someone who's been high up in the Babylonian kingdom and has been doing politics, has been ruling, has been administering the kingdom for so long, has been so honest, has done his job. Of course, he has enemies, but there was no basis, real basis for a complaint. There was no corruption. There's no lying. There's no none of the things they could get him for. And they realized the only way we could get him would be something about the way he serves his God. Would it not be an amazing thing for that to be said about us? That the only thing you could really, with any basis, you can always lie, but with any basis for an accusation, the only thing you could think about would have to be, well, it's got to be something to do with them being Christians. Because other than that, they really do a good job. They don't break the laws. They don't take bribes. In other words, what if we were people that the only way you could criticize us was for being Christians? Now, you do see that. Some of our Christian beliefs, people say, well, because you believe that, it must mean that you are fill in the blank, racist, homophobic, transphobic, Islamophobic, whatever. In other words, there are accusations that can be leveled against us because of our beliefs. Those aren't true, but those are the only possible accusations that you find. So that was the case with Daniel. So these high officials came by agreement. So this is a plot. They've plotted this, right? So they've tapped his phone and they tried to find things about him and they can't find anything. So they come together and they go to the king and they decide we're going to exploit his commitment to his God. And it's really pretty clever. It's evil, but it's clever. Listen to this. He said, "O King Darius, live forever. All the high officials of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, everybody agrees," that's not true, "but that the king should establish an ordinance and enforce an injunction that whoever prays to any god or man for the next 30 days except you shall be cast into a den of lions." Now, what are they doing? They're saying, we love you so much. We want to make sure that everybody loves you as much as we do, which should make you suspicious when you hear that kind of thing. But basically, we want everybody to declare their loyalty to you. So for 30 days, no one can pray to any of their gods anywhere in the kingdom. They can only pray to you. And so, O king, establish this injunction and sign this document so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians. I want to make one little point, side point. The law of the Medes and the Persians. Isn't that interesting? It makes it sound like the Medes and the Persians are one empire now, not two, and that happened under Cyrus. So understand the details here that this isn't the Medians and the Persians, that with Cyrus, they're one kingdom, and that this cannot be revoked according to the laws of the Medes and the Persians. Therefore, King Darius signed the document and the injunction. Well, this idea of the rules of the Medes and the Persians, and this is an irrevocable thing, this is really unusual to us. We think not only can laws be repealed, all it takes is a district court judge to issue an injunction and stop something. That's not the way it was in the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. There was a tradition that once the king had signed this document, it couldn't be repealed. This sounds unusual to us, but there's some historical verification of this. Later in history, there is a Greek historian named Diodorus, and he lived around 330. He's talking about an event, but actually in about 330 BC with a Persian king. And he tells the story of a Persian king at that time who issues a decree. Somebody's going to be killed, later regrets it, but records that, I regret doing this. This was the wrong thing to do, but it cannot be changed. So in other words, this idea, which is very strange to us, this rings very historically true because you have a little bit of verification that this was indeed one of the traditions of the Medes and the Persians. So he signed the document. When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, and this is probably, honestly, the high point of this story. I know the high point's going to be with the lions later, but I would argue this is the high point of the story. When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. That "as he had done previously" is interesting to me. I mean, there's so many interesting things about this. But the first thing I want to point out is this. The world had changed. The law had changed in this case. But Daniel's worship of his God had not changed. And I would argue to you that one of the reasons to know church history, to read the New Testament, look at the book of Acts, and see how did the earliest Christians live their lives, is because no matter how much technology changes, no matter how much the world changes, we go from kingdoms to nations to whatever it may be, whatever changes in the world, our worship of God fundamentally does not change. And that's one of the great lessons about Daniel, is Daniel had to say, am I going to change with the times? Of course, you change with the times to some extent. I mean, you drive cars instead of a horse and buggy, and you use a smartphone instead of a pager. I mean, of course you change to some extent. But fundamentally, when the values of the world change, our worship of God does not change. And that's part of what the scripture means when it says God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. It means his love is constant, his mercy is constant, his grace is constant, but it also means our covenant, our response to him is the same today as it was 2,600 years ago. So he begins, he goes back, and he continues to pray. Now, here's the interesting thing when it comes to what we would call this today is civil disobedience. He's not rioting. He's not taking up arms and decide he's going to assassinate Cyrus or he's going to start a rebellion. This is called civil disobedience, and it simply means that I cannot in good conscience follow that law. I'm going to continue to pray to my God, and if indeed there are consequences, then I will pay those consequences. Do you remember in chapter 3 the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? When they were young men, that was also civil disobedience. He said, here's the law, bow down, worship this idol. They didn't say, we're gonna overthrow your government, we're gonna go burn and loot and do all kinds of things. What they said was, we won't worship your idol. And if that means you're gonna burn us in the furnace, then throw us into the furnace. But we cannot in good conscience bow down to this idol. We serve God and we only serve God. But it's rarely that cut and dried. I mean, think about this civil disobedience. It's always more difficult than that. What if Daniel had just decided, well, I don't really want to be thrown into a den of lions, but I'm not going to pray. What if I just stop praying for 30 days? You see, the enemy would like to get little by little, little compromises, not big compromises. Most of our challenges are small things. And so you could have said to Daniel, Daniel, just don't pray for 30 days. God will forgive you for that. And then you can go back to praying and you'll be safe. But you see, what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had decided and what Daniel has decided is safety is not his highest value. Worshiping God is his highest value. And so civil disobedience is his only choice, meaning serve God rather than man. You see this all through the history of, I mean, obviously Acts chapter 5, you get that famous story of the Jewish leaders after the resurrection of Christ, and people are becoming Christian when they hear the good news about Christ. And they call in Peter and John and they beat them and they order them, don't talk about Jesus. Well, they could have just said, okay, well, I think we'll leave town and maybe we'll go somewhere else and talk about Jesus. Or maybe we'll just keep it quiet while we're in Jerusalem. But they didn't. What did they say? Judge for yourself whether it is right for us to serve God or to serve you. They knew that Jesus had told them, go into all the world, make disciples of all the nations. And so their point was, safety is not our primary concern. And in fact, to stop talking about Jesus would be disobeying our God and placing you higher than our God. In more recent times, another famous, famous story, think of Corrie Ten Boom. You get in World War II, and you were supposed to turn Jews into the Nazi authorities. And the story of Corrie Ten Boom, I commend it to you. You should read that. But the idea of hiding Jews, civil disobedience, it's breaking the law, not by shooting at the Nazi soldiers or overthrowing the government. They did what they could do, and what that was is I could hide these Jews, risking her life, her family's life, nevertheless, to do what is right in the sight of God versus what is right in the sight of Hitler. And so over and over again, you're going to see these things, and generally they come with smaller temptations. But Daniel didn't hesitate. He went and he did what he had always done. He bowed down three times a day toward Jerusalem and prayed. Well, before we go on with the story, it might be worth talking about this praying toward Jerusalem. This is a custom. And it, remember, this is in about we're talking now in the Persian era, about 538 BC, right around there. Well, about 400 years earlier, Solomon had built the temple of God. And you can read about this in the book of 1 Kings in the Old Testament. But there's some allusions there to the idea of praying toward the temple. And so it was the custom then became to pray toward Jerusalem, pray toward the, if you're in Jerusalem, then you pray toward the temple mount. But if you're outside Jerusalem, you pray toward Jerusalem. And that's what he was doing. He was doing this three times a day, which is interesting. And again, that's a matter of custom. In more modern times, it was common in the Middle Ages for monks to pray seven times a day, still in some orders to pray seven times a day, which raises an interesting question of how often should we pray? Well, the New Testament talks about pray without ceasing, and that means live a life of constant communion with God. But if I could just give you a suggestion for those of you that don't have a kind of a regular prayer life, is I think a good way to start is morning and night. Open your day with a prayer to God and close your day with a prayer to God. Three times a day, seven times a day, praying ceaselessly, if you will. That is a wonderful thing. But if you're not praying, I would urge you to let's follow Daniel's example to some extent and pray at morning and pray at night. Well, that's what he was doing. Needless to say, his enemies knew that he was doing that. And so these men came by agreement, meaning this is a plot, and they found Daniel praying and pleading before his God. I would imagine he's praying about this. And he's saying, God, deliver me from this, but no matter what happens, I'm serving you. And he's praying about this, and they catch him in the act, as they know they would. So they came before the king. And they said, O king, didn't you sign an injunction which said that anyone who prays to any god or man within the next 30 days except you should be cast in the den of lions? And the king answered and said, yes, and this stands fast according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked. Then they answered and said, aha, gotcha. Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the injunction, but he continues to pray three times a day. Then the king, when he heard these words, first of all, you can tell from what follows that the king really respects Daniel. He cares about Daniel. I mean, when you think about these advisors, he's got to be thinking, Daniel's the only guy here that isn't trying to take advantage of me. Daniel's the only guy here I can really trust. Also in this moment, he has to have realized that he's been duped by these guys. And so the king then, his reaction is, when he heard these words, he was very distressed, and he did everything he could to deliver Daniel. He looked for loopholes in the law until the sun went down of a way to rescue Daniel. So this must have been found out in the morning or noon, and the sentence would be executed that day. And so he works and works to try to find a way around this, but he cannot. And so then they came by agreement in the evening and said, it's the law of the Medes and Persians that this cannot be changed. In other words, you are going to follow through with this, aren't you? Because if you're not, we're probably going to get on social media and start talking about how the king doesn't really follow the law and maybe he shouldn't be king. Then the king commanded, Daniel was brought and he was cast into the den of lions. He was dropped into a pit, basically, in there with the lions. The king declared to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve continually, deliver you. Now, this is interesting, too. Even the king knew, and this is what you had to say about Daniel. He could have said, Daniel, I trust you, you're a trusted advisor. I hope that somehow you escape. Daniel, I hope that your God can save you because there's nothing that I can do. Instead, he says, may your God, whom you continually serve, to whom you are so very devoted, to whom you are radically devoted. And I think this is also a lesson for us, is that Daniel's worship of his God was not something he didn't worship the Babylonian gods, he didn't worship the Persian gods, but he didn't make a show of it. He simply went about following his God and worshiping his God, but he didn't do it in secret. It was obviously known that Daniel loved and served his God. And so I wonder sometimes, is it known that we continually serve our God? Is that what we are known for? Are we as radical as Jesus seemed to be? And when I say radical, I mean radically committed to serving God. What does that lead to? In Daniel's case, it led to being a good employee, to being honest, to being trustworthy, to doing his best in his job, and being well thought of by the people who noticed what he was doing, and being poorly thought of by the people who resented him. I would argue that you can sometimes measure the strength of our faith by who our enemies are. That's certainly true in terms of Daniel, is that Daniel's commitment to his God shows up most visibly because of who his enemies were. Well, the king says, may your God preserve you, whom you continually serve. And so they brought a stone, laid it on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own ring. The reason for this is that it's going to be obvious that no one's playing around with the law. We really are going to follow the law, and I've sealed it so that if anybody moves this stone and sneaks him out in the middle of the night, it'll be known. In other words, this is going to be above board. And so he seals it. And then, so that nothing could be changed. Then the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No diversions were brought to him, and sleep fled from him. You can see that he's really upset. I think he's upset for two reasons. One is I think he really values Daniel. But secondly, he also realizes the injustice that has been done. And I do think in time, not always at the time, but when you see this kind of deception, it always comes to light at some point, and it usually backfires. So the king has a sleepless night, and then at the break of day, at dawn, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. And as he came near to the den, he cried out in a tone of anguish. And the king declared, O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? Now, this is interesting because by all accounts, the Persian ruler, Cyrus, is not, he's a religious man in the sense that he pays homage to his gods. How much of that he really believes, we don't know. But it's interesting that he realizes that this situation is so hopeless and so cut and dried that only Daniel's God could possibly keep him alive overnight with these lions. That even he realizes that, you know what? The only way you're going to survive is if there's a God. Your God is real and your God is powerful. And that is a key to why this works out the way it does. And so Daniel replies, O king, live forever. My God has sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me because I was found blameless before him, and I have been blameless before you, O king. I have done no harm. Then the king was exceedingly glad and commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den. So he was taken up and no harm was found on him. Why? Because he had trusted in his God. You know, this is an interesting comparison. Back in chapter 3, when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were supposed to bow down to the idol, Daniel wasn't there. And we talked at that time that Daniel had been made by Nebuchadnezzar years earlier. He'd been made number two. He was probably back in Babylon. And so, but Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego have their moment of faith, their moment to find out, will you serve God? Or will you choose safety? Will you choose security? And now, so many decades later, Daniel, an old man, faces his moment of, will you serve God or will you choose safety and security over God? And just as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had done as young men, Daniel, the old man, maintains his faith because he had trusted in God. Well, at this point, the king is not one who likes being made a fool of. And so the king commanded, and those men who had maliciously accused Daniel were brought and cast into the den of lions, they, their children, and their wives. Okay, so the Persian kings were not exactly good guys. But you see the point that's being made here is like, you tried to kill your political enemy, and consequently, it's going to come back on you. This is not something we today would think of as justice necessarily, or it wouldn't be the way that we would mete out justice. But in its harshest terms, this is justice in the Persian Empire. And before they even reached the bottom of the den, the lions overpowered them and killed them. Then King Darius wrote to all the people, nation, and languages that dwell in all of the earth, in all of his kingdom, Peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree. This is interesting because Nebuchadnezzar, decades before, had issued a decree to the Babylonian Empire saying, the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is a real God. He's the living God. He's a powerful God. I don't want anybody saying anything disrespectful. And we talked at that time when we studied that, what an impact that had, that the ruler of the world, even though he didn't change his faith and say, I believe in your God and your God alone, he acknowledged that this God is powerful. And who knows how that was used. And here we are with the Persian king doing the exact same thing. He said, I decree that in all my royal dominion, people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel because he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed and his dominion shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius. Some translate this even the reign of Cyrus. In other words, this can be translated as Darius, who was also known as Cyrus. It can be translated Darius and Cyrus, which doesn't make any sense. To me, this still argues for the fact that these are the same people. But nevertheless, the point I want to make is that here you get a witness from a non-believer about the power of God. And we talked about that previously, that it's a powerful witness that Daniel, through his faith, was willing to die for what his God called him to do. And God then sparing him used that as a huge witness by his power to spare him. But I want you to think in Hebrews chapter 11, there are times when Daniel's mentioned there that it takes great faith and God shut up the mouth of lions, but it takes great faith and many were killed for their faith. You see, in God's economy, which is an eternal economy, faith is the currency. It's not the deliverance or not the deliverance. God delivers or not according to his plan. He loved Daniel. He loved the people that were killed for their faith. He loved all the Christians who have been and are still being today martyred for their faith. And he's using these things to impact the world. It will judge those who perpetrate those things and perhaps save those who do not and can see it. Sometimes we win by being delivered and living, and sometimes we win by dying. Reminds me of a story. I think I've mentioned it to you before, but it bears repeating. Back in the 1980s, in communist USSR, in Romania, there was a Christian pastor named Joseph Son. Joseph Son was really well known in that era, probably the most famous pastor in Romania in that area. And he was preaching the gospel when it was not legal to preach the gospel. Of course, he'd been hauled in by the secret police many times and he'd been threatened, but he kept doing it. So I'll shorten the story a little bit, and his story is well worth reading. But basically, one time they call him in, they come in, and they realize, and they say to him, listen, enough of this. This is against the law. Do you not understand that we have the power to kill you right now, and no one cares? It's not against the law. We'll get in no trouble whatsoever. You don't seem to understand that we can kill you, and there are no repercussions whatsoever. And Joseph Son says back, and I'm paraphrasing this, but this is really powerful. He said, you know, your highest power is that you can kill me, but my superpower is that I am willing to die. Now, which do you think is more powerful? And the truth has been throughout all of history that the willingness to lay down our life for God because of our faith has been far more powerful than the people in the world who have the ability to kill us. That is the story of Christianity. That is Jesus Christ overcame sin and death, not by battling it, but by dying to sin and death so that you and I could be freed. That is the gospel. This Daniel is, before he ever knows that Jesus will come, before he could imagine it, Daniel is playing out the gospel truth, that trust in God and you will be saved. This is a powerful, powerful story. It's a story that can be told to children and have a great moral, and it's a story that can be told to us as adults in its historical context. And it rings true not just 2,600 years ago. This story is a very modern story. Political intrigue, the willingness to kill your political opponents in order to serve your ends, the response of being faithful to God, even in the face of death in Daniel's case, and God overcomes. We have seen that played out in the last few months in many ways in our culture. It is the story of Daniel playing itself out again. Well, Daniel chapter 6 ends the first half of the book. And so we have seen these faith-building lessons from history that God means for us to apply today, from the time Daniel was a teenager until the time he was a very old man. In our next lesson, as we continue, the second half of the book of Daniel is Daniel recording throughout this time of his life these visions, these prophecies, and these prophecies take the form of predicting what is going to happen in the future. In chapter 7, probably many think this is the center point chapter of the book of Daniel, we see Daniel's prophecies about the Ancient of Days and the end times. In our next lesson, buckle your seatbelts, we'll dive deeply into end times prophecy.